Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
All right, welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm not Justin Burke, but I am Chris the Chimanchu, and I have our producer here, Dr. Clara Mao. Say hi.
Hey, everyone.
Tonight we have, or today, I guess depends what time you listen to it, but we did record during the day. We have Dr. Maida Khalid to discuss hemolytic uremic syndrome, also known as HUS. I don't think we ever called it HUS, have we? No, so. But first, before we get to that, I'll give it to Clara to remind us about the show.
So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine. Today, we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Khalid, who is a pediatric nephrologist and associate fellowship director at Riley Hospital for Children and Indiana University. Her research interests are in glomerular diseases, including today's topic of shigatoxin-associated hemolytic uremic syndrome. Today, she teaches us about the manifestations of HUS, how to collect a stool sample, and the different types of renal replacement therapy that are available.
I'm excited for our audience to listen about HUS with us. I guess that's not really a pun, but close enough.
I love it.
Hello, Dr. Maida Khalid. Thank you for coming on the show. Because we're an informal group, is it okay if I address you by your first name?
Please do.
Okay. All right. So we're going to start off with a couple of quick questions just to warm up. Could you give us a couple lines about yourself? Tell us who you are and maybe add some things outside of medicine that you're interested in.
Yes. So I am a pediatric nephrologist and I work at Riley Hospital for Children at Indiana University. Of course, HUS is one of my research interests. About myself, I am a mother of two, married to a physician, and of course I love the usual things everybody loves, right? Being outdoors, cooking, eating, reading. What I like, which is a little different from other people, is gardening, and then I love bread making, all sorts of breads. And I go at it with a perfection. I'll spend months like making the same thing and then just churning out loaves and loaves and loaves and different breads from different cultures. It's probably a stress relief, but that's the fun fact.
Very cool.
That's awesome. What was the last bread that you made?
You know, multigrain. It's easy. You throw every seed in the kitchen in the bread and then you just give it a couple of rises over a few days.
That's awesome.
Do you also have your own like starter that you use, or are you using industrial yeasts? Or
I have a friend who has a starter. When in need, call the friend.
Nice.
So you don't have to keep it alive. You can just borrow it as needed.
Yes.
You mentioned in the pre-show when we were chatting that you listen to podcasts. What are your favorite podcasts to listen to right now?
Very generic. New York Times. I'll pull it up. The Guardian, Nature, and The Atlantic.
Nice. It's a good group of podcasts.
It's how I keep myself up to date with what's happening.
Yeah, sometimes it's very difficult these days. There's so much happening in the world, too many elections to keep count of. So,
yeah, I also think it gives me an opportunity to slow down and just listen, not use my eyes. And it's a moment of 20 or 30 minutes where I can just focus and not be distracted, flipping through things.
So one of the missions we have for this podcast is partially career development. So I was just wondering, what's the best advice you ever received as a learner or given as a teacher?
This is for my whole life. And I carry this around very close to my heart. Perfection is the enemy of good.
Absolutely. That's a good one. So good. I think I once heard Adam Savage, who, you know, from Mythbusters, he's got a great YouTube. He considers himself a maker, but basically a project's done when you're finally giving up on it. So like, yeah, otherwise you just continue, you can continue to work on it until forever. So,
yeah.
Hey, Cribsiders listeners, Factor is back with more deals for you. Fuel up these warm summer days with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. This is also a shout out to the brand new intern starting this July who could use some quick, nutritious food options. With Factor, there are 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. These include restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon. So check out all their meal plans by heading to factormeals.com/cribsetters50 and use code cribsetters50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code cribsetters50 at factormeals.com/cribsetters50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month, all while your subscription is active. See you soon, listeners. Stay tuned.
All right. So, Clara, should we get into our first case?
Yes. So let's say that, you know, you're in the emergency room seeing Jimmy, who was a previously healthy two-year-old, coming in with 3 days of vomiting, diarrhea, belly pain, fever. Initially, the diarrhea was brown, but then this morning it started to have streaks of blood in it. He is tachycardic and appears kind of dehydrated with delayed cap refill on exam. His abdomen is soft, but seems tender to palpation diffusely. And just because of how severely he presents, you decide to get labs. So his renal panel shows hyponatremia to 133. He has an elevated creatinine to 0.9 for age. And his urinalysis has trace blood and ketones. CBC shows some anemia with a hemoglobin of 10 and some thrombocytopenia with a platelet count of 100. Kind of starting from the basics, we see a lot of kids in the emergency room and in primary care who come in with these symptoms, and they're most often attributed to a viral gastroenteritis. So in the context of this episode, you know, what is HUS and why in this case would you specifically be thinking about that?
So disclaimer, I study HUS, I'm a nephrologist, you know, that is how I view the world. But I have to tell you that there are a couple of things that as I have worked with the ED group in our hospital that I would flag for you. So generally in a child younger than 5 years of age, during the summer months, acute blood diarrhea that turns bloody should alert you to screen for Shiga toxin-producing E. coli. If nothing else, it should alert you to do a stool culture or a stool GI pathogen panel. That's really important. The stool culture can take up to 24, 48 hours to come back. However, the GI pathogen panels are game changers, and depending on your institution, can come back in a couple of hours to the next day. We are utilizing them with great success, because when that comes back positive, you know that you absolutely need to get labs now and you need to, you know, watch this patient more carefully.
So what's in a GI pathogen panel? And so this is a stool study?
It is. A GI pathogen panel, you can take a little swab and run a PCR, and it runs a PCR for the most common pathogens that can give you a diarrheal illness. So Shiga toxin producing E. coli is one of them.
And so can you explain more about Shiga and Shiga toxin and what's going on there? How is this causing diarrhea and why is it bloody specifically?
Yeah, so let me start from the beginning. Okay, all good stories start from somewhere. So we're going to imagine that there's a little child and then there's an E. coli bug. Now, they're both living their lives, okay, and trying to survive. So this is where the story begins with the E. coli. So E. coli are in cow manure. It is typically, we can trace back to somebody's poop, okay? And it's usually cows, sheep, other animal. And the runoff from the manure of these animals is being used to irrigate fields. So if you eat the meat, so a lot of times the ground meat, which has some skin contamination from these animals, or you're eating fruits and vegetables that have been irrigated with a runoff of these, or any other sort of contamination points such as sprouts or alfalfa or salad leaves, strawberries, then that E. coli has a way of entering your body. And it's like, okay, now time for evolution to take place, and the E. coli is going to, the whole goal of the E. coli is to kind of spread itself, right? So that's why you get an illness, which is diarrhea and vomiting, because, well, this is my opinion. Okay, so I think, so, you know, because you're pooping everywhere and you're vomiting anywhere, and now these E. coli are multiplying and they're spreading, okay? So the E. coli gets ingested, and it can take like a day for the symptoms to begin. Whether the first symptom is vomiting or diarrhea or abdominal pain, eventually most children get diarrhea, and it can take up to 2 days for that diarrhea to become bloody. It becomes bloody because you're starting to damage the intestinal lining and the intestinal wall. And in part, that is because of the sugar toxin, which is directly toxic to these cells. This is the point at which most children will present to a healthcare provider, whether that is the emergency room or their primary care doctor or the minute clinic somewhere. And this is such a critical point where testing needs to be done. So I do work with the State Department here in Indiana, and we've been working very aggressively at disseminating information in local emergency rooms and to local pediatric and MedPeds practices, that if a child who's young who comes to you with acute bloody diarrhea, send a culture. It's not always E. coli. We've seen outbreaks of Shigella, occasionally Listeria, occasionally any other severe diarrhea-causing illness can cause a rectal fissure, which can give you blood, right? But we need to know what's happening. So that's sort of your cycle with the whole diarrheal illness. Now, most people get better. We see HUS develop more, and I'm not saying only, we see it more in children younger than 5, and then there's an uptick after 60 age-wise. So for you guys who are MedPeds, if you see an elderly person in the ED with the acute bloody diarrhea, I would check it out as well. And no one quite knows why it's children under 5, but one mechanism that has been put forward is that there are these receptors, the GB3 receptors, and they're expressed more when you're younger and probably start to be expressed less as you grow older. And the expression of these cells is certainly a lot more in the kidney cells, which is why when we get HUS, and I'll talk about that in a minute, what happens in HUS, but when you get HUS, the kidneys are affected. And other organs with some of this expression may be also affected. Now, you've got a child, there's bloody diarrhea. It can take another 3 days to 5 days for HUS to occur. What is HUS? Now, back to the story. Now, this E. coli has entered the intestine, and it's spitting out these Shiga toxins. Shiga toxin can be Shiga toxin 1, it can be Shiga toxin 2, or it can be a bacteria that produces Shiga toxin 1 and 2. Remember that it's always a combination of 1 and 2 or 2 that will lead to HUS. Generally, only Shiga toxin 1 producing bacteria don't cause bloody diarrhea and don't lead to HUS. Reported, there are certainly case reports, but it tends to be that we need Shiga toxin 2. And in fact, there's data to suggest out of Italy that if you had exclusively Shiga toxin 2, your likelihood of HUS and your severity of HUS may be worse than just with Shiga toxin 1 and 2. So now this E. coli is spitting out this Shiga toxin, and this Shiga toxin enters the bloodstream, and it starts to damage endothelial cells along the small blood vessels. And what does the body do when the endothelial cells get damaged? The protective mechanism is clamp down and clot, right? That's how a lot of sort of... And so that is why you see the platelets drop, because they're being consumed in these microthrombi. And that is why the hemoglobin drops, because as the red blood cells try to pass through these tiny clots in small blood vessels, they're being broken down and they burst. And so there's a hemolytic anemia. And in fact, that's why we have kidney failure in 60% of the acute kidney injury or kidney disease in 60% of the affected children, because now you've got microthrombi in the kidney and the kidney cannot be perfused and it's stuffed full of tiny clots and it can't work. There are extra renal complications of HOS. So HOS by definition is hemolytic anemia, thrombocytopenia, and acute kidney injury. Other things we see is neurological involvement, and up to 20 to 30%, depending on the studies, and neurological involvement can be in its most severe form, seizures and clots, but also altered mental status, irritability, slightly sort of comatose sort of presentation. And we believe that clearly there are microthrombi in the brain, but also perhaps a little bit of direct gigotoxin toxicity contributing. We can see pancreatitis in some patients. There's almost always amylase lipase elevation, but it has to exceed like several fold to be called pancreatitis. And that's also a microthrombi in the pancreas. Similarly, microthrombi have been reported in heart. It's very rare. Retina, again, very rare. We know it affects the liver, but somehow the liver doesn't take a big hit. It recovers. And the bowel wall. So that can be tough because there are cases of severe hemorrhagic colitis or bowel ischemia, bowel perforation. And we know that the microthrombi have a role to play there.
Thank you for giving us such a great overview of HOS. I think something that in our podcast that we really like to highlight is discussions about health disparities or public health issues surrounding some of these topics. And the work that you do in your research, have you come across any kind of information about this?
The information right now in the United States about the impact of healthcare disparities is lacking. It's something I'm working on currently in collaboration with the State Department of Health. As I've mentioned to you, I work with them. However, there's a very tight link between public health and HOS. So let's take a step back, and I'll tell you that I mentioned HOS affects children under the age of 5. So there's a 15% chance that a child who's infected with gigotoxin-producing E. coli will get HOS. And so we're talking about a perfectly healthy young child, and this can be a devastating disease. Gigotoxin-producing E. coli is supposed to be reported to the State Department of Health by all labs that do stool testing. So this infrastructure is in place in every state, and this reporting is done automatically. Labs are set up. In fact, if there's a positive stool culture, the State Department of Health collects that stool culture so they can do genotyping, and at the back end, figure out if there's an outbreak, because what you see is the same genotype pop up from four different people. And so you know that there was a common source, and we need to track this quickly. And that's how you, if you read in the news that there's an outbreak and it was from a particular thing such as spinach or strawberries, that's how they figured it out. So, you know, like all other systems, there's always room for improvement. So we work locally with labs to not only report it to the State Department of Health, but to report it very, very quickly. Because then the team at the State Department of Health actually reaches out to the families and they talk to them and they ask, where have you been? Where have you eaten? Where did you vacation? What were your exposures? So that a common source can be figured out. Similarly, if a child develops hemolytic uremic syndrome, that is also mandatory reporting. And we've been working over the last several years to report this quickly and promptly to the State Department so that we can call the families and track down common sources. And this is important because the faster you figure out what's causing the E. coli infection, the more quickly you can control it and stop it.
Great. And I know this, the focus of this topic obviously is the gigotoxin producing E. coli causing HOS. But what are some other causes of HOS that we, you know, can think about if we didn't have that kind of stool pathogen testing?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, HOS is hemolytic uremic syndrome. And we talked about the pathophysiology, which is endothelial damage and microthrombi formation. So anything that causes endothelial damage and subsequent microthrombi formation by definition can give you HOS. So several things. In the spectrum of infectious disease, there are reports with viruses and a slightly different kind of HOS, which is strep pneumo. And the mechanism of that is different. There are medications. Tacrolimus is pretty notorious. Chemotherapy and radiation. We see an HOS-like picture in stem cell transplant patients frequently. So, of course, not to forget what is called atypical hemolytic uremic syndrome, which we now know is linked to an overactive complement cascade activation, and whether that is because of factors.
And if someone, you know, came in with obviously this triad of anemia, thrombocytopenia, acute kidney injury, what else, like what other disease processes might be on your differential besides HUS?
Lupus, cancer, cold agglutinins, mycoplasma infections, sepsis. However, the history is very compelling. And I'll tell you a couple of interesting stories from my experience over the last 15 years. I love stories. There are times you're not sure because your stool culture isn't positive or your stool culture isn't done or testing isn't done. And then you find out that a sibling has bloody diarrhea. And I remember there was a child, we couldn't get the stool test to be positive. And so the State Department is very strict. You need a positive stool culture or GI pathogen panel to label it as HUS, and that goes into sort of national tracking. And, you know, the question always comes up, well, if we don't have stool culture, what if this is atypical HUS? You know, what do you do? And that is $1 million workup. Well, the parents were really nice. They said, you know what? Our daughter has started to get diarrhea, and it turned bloody. They live 2 hours away. I was like, just somehow bring me a stool sample. Bring me a stool sample. We'll submit it to the lab. I remember like they ran home. They got here a few minutes before the lab was supposed to close. We called the lab and we said, there's a stool sample coming. The office quickly created a medical record encounter for this patient. And then we ran that stool to the lab. And I remember the lab tech paging me and saying, Dr. Khaled, we've got the stool, which is great. And that tested positive. So I do think that when you've got a history that fits and you've got a child under the age of 5 and you really should make every effort to confirm if this is shigatoxin producing associated HUS, because really in the summer months, that's going to be the more likely thing that's happening. If something doesn't quite fit, you know, you have no history of bloody diarrhea, you have no history of diarrhea, you have no sick contacts, it's winter, somebody is age 12, then I think it behooves us to explore other causes.
One question I have is I always feel, you know, there's this, I think there's a nuanced distinction that I always forget between HUS and TTP. Or can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think I still have trouble in my mind. You know, I've been practicing for so long now, and I still have trouble remembering exactly the difference.
Yeah, a kidney involvement is the difference. So with TTP, you don't have renal involvement, and with HUS, you do.
Gotcha. And so keeping those and some of the other sort of differentials that you've already mentioned, what types of other laboratory work would you send? So obviously the stool workup is very important. Are there other types of labs that you haven't mentioned that you would suggest? And would you get other imaging? Like, is there abdominal imaging that would be useful?
So what I would recommend is a lot depends on the clinical appearance of the child and how they look when they've presented to you in the emergency or the clinic. However, with acute bloody diarrhea, it is helpful to get the labs that Clara, you mentioned the child had, which is a CBC. So you definitely want to look for anemia, thrombocytopenia. And sometimes if children are very dehydrated, the hemoglobin is high. And that is an indication that this child could benefit from hydration. Definitely electrolytes, BUN and creatinine. I would throw in an albumin in there. I'm partial to that. A urine analysis can be very difficult to get in a child with diarrhea, and it's almost always going to be a contaminated sample. And I would not encourage using a catheter to get a catheterized urine specimen at the time. We can seed, cause a UTI at the time. So I don't push for a urine analysis or a urine culture, of course, unless clinically you're worried about bile. That's a whole different story. I like to get an LDH, and a haptoglobin is not the first thing I would do, but LDH is good in the ED or a quick screen, because if it's high, hemoglobin's low, platelets are low, you will find that happening even before the BUN and the creatinine have had a chance to rise. So that would be my first set of labs. And then if you've decided to admit the child, that's a whole different discussion.
And besides, you know, earlier you mentioned a lot of the different organ systems that can be involved. We talked about CNS, pancreatitis, acute kidney injury. Any other organ systems or manifestations that we should think about?
I think start there. That's pretty good. So if we have decided, let's say next steps, right? So now your child was in the ED, we've decided this child is not doing well. They're not tolerating oral fluids. They live 3 hours away from the emergency room. We should bring them in for hydration. And let's say the next day, the urine output is not the best, the bloody diarrhea is still pretty bad. I definitely do an amylase lipase. I would do a haptoglobin. I would do an LDH. And this would be part of my daily labs, as well as the LFTs. And then neurological involvement is something that can be very unsettling. I do neurochecks. You can do that depending on the child every 8 hours. Pulse ox if they're critically ill. And there's nothing like a good old physical exam. You have to feel the belly. And you don't have to feel it once. It has to be the same person checking on the patient 2 to 3 times a day, because they're the ones who are going to know if the physical exam has changed.
And what are you looking on your abdominal exam specifically? Yeah.
So bellies are going to hurt. And, you know, the thing that I worry about the most is perforation or intestinal ischemia. And there are studies pointing to the fact that when that happens, the mortality is higher and the severity of HUS is higher. Also, you know, you have to start thinking about what sort of dialysis are you going to do if you're going to need it. With a bowel that's ischemic, we're not going to do peritoneal dialysis. We're going to be thinking of CVVH, a blood not dialyzing through the abdomen. This, Clara, is a very difficult question to answer. And in fact, when I review papers, this comes up quite a bit. You know, can we create some sort of a framework or a risk score where we can say, hey, this is the patient who's going to perf and this is the patient who's not going to perf? Another story. So I was taking over from one of my very experienced partners, and there was an HUS patient, and she said, hey, this patient is in the ICU, they're on CVVH. The audience, if they know what CVVH is, it is continuous veno-venous hemodialysis. You just directly put your dialysis catheter in a large vessel and you... it's blood form of dialysis. And she said, they're on CVVH. And I said, hey, how did you decide to do CVVH? We typically do peritoneal dialysis. And she said, well, actually, you know, this child had an intestinal perforation. And I said, well, hold on. How did you figure out they had an intestinal perforation? Because everybody comes in with belly pain and they're moaning and groaning. And she said, well, actually, believe it or not, I sent this child for a peritoneal dialysis catheter placement. And when they went in laparoscopically to look in the abdomen, they saw that there was intestinal necrosis.
Whoa.
That's terrifying.
That's very scary.
It is terrifying. This is why when you have a HUS patient on your service, you are not sleeping. Your cortisol is through the roof and you're unsettled till they actually turn the corner. Because this is a disease where a few hours can change everything. And in so many morbidity mortality meetings where we have unfortunately lost patients to intestinal ischemia and subsequent sepsis and death, that's the question we ask ourselves. How would we have picked this up earlier? And it's difficult. I do think that there are a couple of things we can set in place that will help us. One, if your belly exam is one of an acute abdomen, call your surgeons. They are your friends. They will come, they will examine the patient. I also think getting a KUB is very low risk. If you see air under the diaphragm, or your radiologist thinks that there's pneumatosis, you have to call the surgeon. And there's nothing wrong with getting a CT of the abdomen in a critically ill child. The risk of missing a perforation is so much higher. And a physician, I'm also trained not to order extra tests, right? We don't want to waste money. We want to be conservative. We don't want to expose children to radiation. And this is a very personal sort of decision where one decides that extra testing is worth it and where we draw the line. I think in HUS patients that you're not sure, it is totally worth it to be aggressive as far as investigations go, because there is a mortality of 3 to 5%. That's very high. You're talking about losing a perfectly healthy child. And that should be a never event in my mind. It should never happen.
So it sounds like we're, you know, slowly talking about our interventions. You know, we have an idea that, you know, say our patient here has HUS, you know, they have renal failure, you know, say they're admitted, we see the creatinine going up, we see worsening anemia, thrombocytopenia. And looks like with our case, Clara, you know, sorry, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it's basically his blood pressures have increased and he had decreased urine output and he's more edematous. And then, of course, we know the stool testing is positive for sugar toxin producing E. coli. So, you know, you said that hydration seems to be one of these first and foremost things that we need to get on. Say we have really a high suspicion that patient has HUS, or at least enough that we need fluids. How much fluids do you decide on? And can the fluids really prevent like full progression to like severe HUS? Or are they just, it's going to happen at some point and you're pretty much trying to mitigate as much damage as you can?
Chris, that is an excellent question. Okay, I'm going to take one step back and give you some statistics. So of the children that get HUS, 60% are going to need dialysis, so somewhere around two-thirds. Now, a couple of years ago out of Italy was this really excellent paper, and there were a few other papers even within the US that in this Italian paper that I'm going to quote, what they did is that they started very aggressively hydrating children that presented with early HUS. And what they found was that both the incidence and the severity of the HUS, and primarily the severity. So this was what they looked at is the number of patients that required dialysis. And it dropped from two-thirds to about one-third. Right now, there is a multi-center randomized controlled trial going on that we are part of, which is NIH funded, looking at exactly that question, Chris. Does aggressive hydration turn the course of HUS and decrease both the incidence and severity? There are definitely suggestions that that seems to be the case. I personally, this is my opinion, that it does make a difference. And the reason I think it makes a difference is we know with kidney injury that you have one insult, and if you add another insult, it's exponential. So when children get vomiting, diarrhea, and fever, they're dehydrated. That is a reason for acute kidney injury. And if we add microthrombi in the kidney on top of that, then we can consider that as a second hit. And then occasionally we've seen reports of children getting NSAIDs or anti-motility agents, those or nephrotoxic medications, and that can be your third insult. So all of these insults add up. So what if we took away one of those factors and we hydrated children? I think intuitively that seems to make sense. But as a scientist, I would tell you we have to wait and see till the data comes out. So hang on a couple of more years and we'll have the answer to that. And this, again, Chris, is so important because one of the things you may have noticed in our conversation is that we don't have a treatment. We only have conservative therapy. And all these years, 20 to 30 years, nothing has changed. Many years ago, they came up with medicine that was supposed to bind the sugar toxin. And everybody thought this is going to prevent HUS from happening, and it didn't. And the reason is that when we talked in the very beginning, you have the bloody diarrhea and the HUS develops about 3 to 5 days later. So by the time you realize somebody has HUS, the toxin's in the bloodstream and it's done its thing. So we can't be giving that medicine to every single person who gets bloody diarrhea. We need something to change with this disease. And so this trial is extremely important because if we show that it decreases the incidence and the severity and it prevents dialysis even in 20 or 30% more children, wouldn't that be lovely?
So what is the current standard of care then? Are we expected to bolus, you know, we see some renal failure, so we start bolusing and start maintenance fluids, or what's generally accepted?
It's all over the place. Okay. It is all over the place. And so one could argue that conservative, just watching these children and seeing what they do and wait for HUS to evolve would be fine. And you could also argue that what we do at our institution is we hospitalize the children. Let me tell you, no parents wants to take their child with high fever, vomiting, diarrhea, and bloody diarrhea home. They're like, yes, please, let's watch him carefully. We do hospitalize the children, we do hydrate them, but you know, everybody's circumstance is different. I have friends who work in Montana and they're taking calls from 3 hours away, you know, and you've got like a snowstorm and mountains to cross to bring a child, you know, to a healthcare facility. And so we do have to improvise based on the circumstances and where we're practicing. And right now, the standard of care varies. And that is why the NIH funded this study, so that we can reach some sort of conclusion. I'm very excited. I can't wait for the results.
We'll have to bring you back on when we get those results so we can do an updated episode.
Yes, we should.
Can you talk a little bit more about maybe transfusion goals, what blood products we should use, what we should not use, and looking at thresholds maybe we should consider when to resuscitate with blood products?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most children are going to need a red blood cell transfusion. That's just how it is. And I tell the parents, don't even worry about it and don't even worry about the number of red blood cell transfusions. Now, I have a cutoff of 7, but remember, it's like where you are in your journey and what direction you're going in. So for example, if your HUS is getting worse and you know the child just presented a day or two ago, then the only direction that hemoglobin is going to be going in is down. And so 7 is a good cutoff. But let's say everything's getting better now. Your child is off of dialysis, they're looking good, and your hemoglobin sitting at 6.5, but your retic count is high. I think you can sit tight. So pay very close attention to where you are in the course, and 7 is generally a good cutoff. If you're in the heat of the moment, I would check labs twice a day, because you could go from an 8 to a 4.
And do you have a platelet goal too?
Very good question. No. So this is expert opinion, and many of the HUS researchers will agree with me that even though platelets are very low in patients with HUS, guess what? They don't bleed. The platelets that they have are very, very sticky. And we published a paper at Indiana University with the surgery team, and it showed that in the children that presented with HUS who got peritoneal dialysis catheters and central lines, they had platelets as low as 15,000, 30,000, but they did not bleed. And most experts, and honestly, I'm in this school, I hold this view as well, is that we have to be really careful about giving platelets because you're adding fuel to the fire. And some people believe that maybe giving platelets can make things worse because now we're giving more platelets to be consumed. And are these microthrombi going to get worse and block arteries more? There's no clear data on that. And in one of my studies, I couldn't find a clear association between platelet transfusion and worse outcomes. But that doesn't mean that that association doesn't exist. It just means that our data or the number of patients we had perhaps were not enough to find a significant result. I would steer clear of platelets if at all possible. Of course, if somebody is actively bleeding, then all bets are over. You have to transfuse.
And, you know, we've talked so much about how this is all related to an E. coli, but we haven't talked about antibiotics. Should we be giving antibiotics in this case? Is there a harm to giving them?
Yeah. So the general consensus, again, is to avoid antibiotics. And, you know, there is data to suggest that they make the condition worse. And certainly we don't recommend treating bloody diarrhea, which is from shigatoxin-producing E. coli, to be treated with antibiotics. You let it run its course, right? And some experts also believe that if you kill the E. coli, they'll release more shigatoxin and it's just going to make things worse. However, let's say you have a child who's got HUS, who is on dialysis, and now you've got a rapidly rising white count and a new fever, then you do have to culture and treat them, right? So, but by that time, I think they've developed HUS and they're pretty severe. So the story changes a little bit. In my opinion, and this is again expert opinion, I think the timing of the antibiotic makes a difference. And I suspect that if you got it very early on in the course, it may make things worse. So avoidance is best.
Easier said than done, right? In practice, you don't know what's going on until it actually happens, right? So
yes, which is why I think stool cultures and GI pathogen panels are so important. So, you know, if you know that this is E. coli or something, you can sit tight. If it's Shigella, you know you've got to treat them.
So obviously you're a pediatric nephrologist, and we are really excited to hear kind of how you think about the acute kidney injury and HUS mm-hmm. and how you decide, you know, when they need renal replacement therapy and what kind of, you know, renal replacement therapy they need.
Yeah, it is always a difficult decision deciding when to pull the trigger and start dialysis. There are tears involved and lots of stress involved. And I would say that if a child's kidney function is getting worse, then I don't wait too long to start dialysis because it can get very stressful when the BUN and creatinine are very high and you're actively hemolyzing and the potassium is rising. So I like to start when I know that the kidneys are really not recovering. So give it about 24 hours in a child who's presenting with not so severe an acute kidney injury. Of course, I have had patients present with a creatinine of 8 and a BUN of 200, and that's not even a discussion, right? You know you're starting. As far as modality goes, this is very center specific. So it depends on the setup you have, the dialysis team, and what everyone is comfortable with. At Indiana University, we do a lot of peritoneal dialysis. The surgery team is very comfortable with placing central lines and peritoneal dialysis catheters. Our dialysis nurses are extremely familiar with doing peritoneal dialysis on the general floor. We don't even have to transfer the patients to the ICU. And I do think there's a lot of flexibility. It's very easy. It's less stressful. You just start with a very gentle prescription. We do that quite a bit. However, there are centers that do hemodialysis or CVVH in the ICU, and that's perfectly acceptable. You know, that is what the system is geared for. And that's where the patient, that's how the patient is going to do the best. I would tell you that there's one very important thing. Remember when I talked to you about the case where I was taking changeover and my partner has started CVVH? If you're at all worried about intestinal involvement, then go straight to CVVH and don't do peritoneal dialysis, because we don't want to be putting a high sugar solution in intestines that are not happy or potentially tilting towards necrosis. Now, overview of dialysis, most children are on dialysis for about a week to 2 weeks. And this is with our traditional approaches of not aggressively hydrating. Maybe this number changes when we have the data from the study. So when I'm counseling parents, I tell them anticipate a week to 2 weeks of dialysis. If children require dialysis for much longer, then I'm having the conversation with the family that we may have some lingering long-term renal disease. So this segues a little bit into what do you expect long-term. And I can pretend right now, like not even pretend, I'll tell you what I discuss with parents. And I say, look, if we need only 1 to 2 weeks of dialysis, chances are that everything is going to be fine, because the data we have suggests that there's excellent recovery and no long-term damage. Even in children who have neurological involvement, outside of a very unexpected and severe stroke, which is exceedingly rare, and I almost wonder if there's another underlying problem in children that develop these complications, neurological recovery is excellent, and children go back to baseline with normal IQs and no complications. And in fact, that is also the case for pancreatitis or hepatitis or other organ system involvements. There is a suggestion that perhaps children who had severe pancreatitis develop diabetes a bit early on long term or are more at risk, but that still has to be proven with more data. If a child is on dialysis for a very long time or their creatinine never normalizes, you know, then I tell parents, yeah, there is a chance that there will be chronic kidney disease. And when we looked at our data in Indiana, over the past sort of 30 years or so, we had approximately 280 patients with diarrhea-positive HUS, and we had about 7 or 8 that required a kidney transplant. Now, there probably are patients that are on dialysis, maybe 1 or 2, but that just sort of gives you an idea. And I do wonder, is there some underlying difference in the children who develop severe HUS compared to those that don't? And we have to wait and see. People have looked at atypical HUS genes in these patients to see if there is a tendency, and we haven't found anything, but I bet we'll have some more answers. This is partly why I'm so passionate about working with the State Department of Health and setting up an infrastructure where we can identify children faster, we can treat them faster, because that is one way to decrease long-term complications and, of course, decrease the burden on the healthcare system at large. So overall, I would say that the prognosis is pretty good. There is no guideline right now that tells you you have to bring the patient back every 6 months and check these labs or those labs. I see patients about once a year to once every 2 years. And of course, those with chronic kidney disease, I'll see as frequently as the stage of kidney disease sort of dictates. But I tell patients, I'm like, just hang in there. I know this is the worst experience of your life, but hopefully I'll be seeing you in clinic in a month. And we're going to be looking back at this as, you know, something that's passed.
In the severe cases of HUS, is there any role for therapies like eculizumab or plasma exchange? I know we see that sometimes in the literature.
Yes. Okay. So eculizumab is really the medicine that we're all talking about. And right now, based on a recent study that was done in France. And it was such a good study. It was a placebo-controlled randomized trial. Like, that's pretty amazing to be able to do with Eculizumab. And they had a lot of children. They did not find a difference in outcomes. But I have to tell you that in Europe and in other places, when children develop neurological complications, many people are giving Eculizumab with the idea that you don't have anything to lose. So I think the jury is out there. And I believe personally that there is a subset of patients that do respond. We just have to figure out what markers we can use to identify those patients. So time will tell. But the most recent randomized controlled trial did not show any benefit of Eculizumab.
And what about plasma exchange therapy?
Yeah, I would avoid that because, of course, there's mixed data. After Eculizumab, nobody sort of has, well, I shouldn't say nobody, but I think plasma exchange is not brought up that frequently. And there's certainly some reports that suggest it might make things worse. And so it is not something that we typically are using. Yeah, it's very hard when you have a patient with HUS who's seizing to just sit there and be like, there's nothing I can do, there's nothing I can do. You know, the instant sort of as a physician, our reaction is we have to do something. We have to get this patient better somehow. But the jury is out there. Let's see.
So I think we've covered like all the potential things that we wanted to talk about in terms of treatment. And we've definitely touched upon like prognosis and long-term complications. I guess now I'm sort of like in a place as a general pediatrician, and you know, this is, you know, summer season right now as we're recording this, and I definitely see kids with GI issues, and we've definitely talked about like trying to get some of our stool studies early on. What are some overall pearls you would give to, you know, an ambulatory pediatrician in their clinic as we start assessing these kids, what we should be looking out for, red flags, just to help us reassure us that some of our ones that we're saying, hey, this is just a, you know, this is a viral illness or this is something else.
Yeah, exactly, Chris. I think it is so hard to be in the shoes of a general pediatrician. I have so much respect for healthcare providers that work in that setting. Because actually, it's very easy when I'm a nephrologist covering the inpatient setting to do Monday morning quarterbacking and go into full aggressive mode and talk about my numbers and statistics. It is such a different skill set to be sitting in the outpatient setting and assessing how aggressive do you need to be. And I'm very cognizant of the fact that getting labs is really hard. You know, we don't always have lab support, and these are little children, and getting blood from a little child is emotionally difficult for everybody, honestly. So I can, I think the first thing I say is everybody makes the decisions based on their circumstances. So I have a lot of respect for that. And I would be the last person to say, this is the rubric and you have to stick with it no matter what. But some helpful hints, right? So again, if we stool culture we can get, I have to give you a pearl here, which is that the CDC even approves this, and most labs are approved to do a culture on a rectal swab. So given that HUS is worse in young children and children under 5, if you have a child who's young with acute diarrhea that has turned bloody, who looks unwell, and they are in clinic, I recognize it is almost impossible to get a stool culture. And one of my very good friends is the chief of the ED department, and if I may quote her, I won't use the exact language, but she said to me, Maida, you want me to do these stool cultures. When was the last time a child who presented to the ED with diarrhea actually gave you a poop sample in the diarrhea? In the ED, tell me. And I was like, you know, you're right. So a rectal swab bypasses that, because you can do a quick rectal swab, and there are instructions on the CDC website, you know, on how to do it, or even you can swab the perianal area and send that to the lab. That can help. And you can carry some of these swabs, if at all possible, in your clinic. And I know EDs carry them, and labs would carry them. So if a child presents to you and you can get that done, it would be super helpful, because now your culture comes back with a reassuring organism. You don't have to do anything. But let's say you have Shiga toxin producing E. coli, then I would say call the family, check in on the patient right away. Okay. If the child is not doing well, they're not tolerating PO, they're lethargic, send them to the emergency room and connect with your local nephrologist or hospitalist that, hey, this child is coming and maybe would benefit from a 24-48 hour of observation. The other thing is sending them to the ED is helpful because then the labs can be done, because that's the time you definitely need a CBC and you need to check the kidney function. That's going to be really, really important. So I've received calls from pediatricians that have very astutely said, I have a patient who is like, whose stool culture is positive for sugatoxin producing E. coli. What do you want me to do? And I'm like, okay, so get either you get labs today or you can send them to the emergency room for labs. And from there on, I think it depends on the infrastructure and the setup. So if a child is really, really far away, I would say, hey, why don't you just come in for a day or two till we make sure the diarrhea has gotten better and you're not progressing into HUS. But if the child looks really good and they live down the road and it's a really reliable family and they have a birthday party that evening, okay, go home, but can we check labs in the next 24 to 48 hours? If they're pushing it to 48 hours, then if the child looks bad, the urine output drops, they get sick, you have to bring them back right away. So that would be my recommendation, that if we're really going to monitor these children in the outpatient setting, we're stuck, you know, at least two labs 48 hours apart or longer. Because remember, it takes 3 to 5 days for the HUS to happen. So you need to check labs again in that time window. You know, that said, this is easier said than done. It's really hard to do. And I salute all of you guys out there in the community taking care of kids. You know, it's an amazing job.
Excellent.
Difficult job.
Well, I definitely appreciate at least these options if we want to be most comprehensive about managing these patients. And hopefully our listeners who have these available and can do them, then at least they have some options that know they should at least try to get.
That's right. One other thing I forgot to mention is that summer months are the peak season. So, Clara, when you reached out to me, I was really excited because I felt that this podcast would be very timely. We are seeing a lot of HUS cases. So, again, if it's summer months, just higher threshold, right? In winter, maybe we still see HUS in the winter, but you could drag your feet a little bit. But summer months, for sure.
Clara, are there any other last questions you want to ask?
No, I feel like we got a really great overview of HUS and how to manage it.
Maida, do you have anything else before we get to our take-home points?
I just want to thank you all for giving an opportunity to me to be here, and it has been my pleasure.
All right. Well, how about you give us your favorite take-home points you think our listeners should walk away from this podcast knowing?
Yeah. Oh, the take-home point would be get a stool culture. And if it's positive, call your nephrologist or infectious disease doctor.
Excellent.
To help. You're never alone. There is always a community.
And it sounds like, you know, if they're going to lab, they're going to be reported. So there are at least other people who are going to be aware that this, you're going to have a positive shake as well.
Absolutely.
Gotcha.
Absolutely. So there's a whole team supporting you guys. No one's alone.
Excellent. So before we sign off, is there anything you'd like to plug? Any groups, websites, organizations that you want our listeners to know about, to look up, check out?
I'd say my biggest plug is hang on, stay tuned for the results of the studies to come. So I've got two cooking. Okay, so we've got the multi-center randomized trial for fluids, and then we're going to be working on data on social and demographic factors that may impact both the development and severity of HUS to hopefully get some more insights. And that in turn will determine public policy or public health policy. So stay tuned. Give us a few years.
Okay. We'll definitely have to have you back when that happens, when we get those results.
It would be my pleasure.
Excellent. Well, thank you again. Appreciate you giving us the time today. And I'm very sure that our listeners, and definitely I and Clara, have learned a lot today. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast player, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producer for this episode, Dr. Clara Mao, and our showrunner, Dr. Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This has been Chris the Chimanchu.
This is Clara Mao.
And now, if you made it to the end, like always, you get to be treated with a brand new poem written by AI. In the dim-lit chamber where shadows blend, a tale unfolds, parent, attend. Your child, though small, faces a grim plight. Hemolytic uremic syndrome strikes tonight. A malady born from E. coli's cruel seed. It ravages swiftly with relentless speed. The blood breaks, the kidneys falter in their core, leaving tiny vessels clogged as platelets wage war. I speak now through the gloom of steps we must take to battle this scourge for your sweet child's sake. First, fluids will flow to cleanse and clear, supporting frail kidneys, bringing solace near. If toxins build high, dialysis may call, a machine to filter blood to correct the appall. Through tubes and whispers, a modern device will purify blood once, not twice. Blood transfusions may join our medicinal fray, replenishing cells swept ruthlessly away. And though the journey's dark, we're guided by light of science and vigilance through the frightful night. Rest now, dear parent, in the hush of our care, with each step measured, precise, and aware. In the battle against shadows, we stand firm and composed to shepherd your child back to health until the darkness is disposed. See you guys. Bye.